Welcome to Tell Me What You're Working On, engaging conversations that celebrate creativity in all its forms. I'm Gabriella Filippi, and in this podcast series, you'll hear from some of the most interesting, intriguing, and creative people in our community. I've been working in the arts and with community for over 25 years. In that time, I've met a ton of creative and inspiring people. Some of them you may know, and some you may not. Their backgrounds are varied, but their stories are always fascinating. We're going to hear about who they are, what they do, how they started, what inspires them, and what they're working on next. Here we go. Have you ever wondered about what it's like to write a book? In the first interview with this series, Tell Me What You're Working On, author Carrie Cox dives into this conversation with me. With a recently released book, So Many Beats of the Heart, she shares her thoughts on writing, creativity during tough times, and surviving a remote writing residency. This interview was recorded a few months ago before her book tour, which she refers to during the conversation, so don't let that confuse you. Hello, Carrie. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So looking forward to talking to you. Congratulations on the release of your book, your second work of fiction.
Yes, thank you.
So Many Beats of the Heart. Can you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Sure. So this book was, it derived from an observation I had a few years ago where within my circle of friends and a little bit wider than that, so we're talking a large circle, some of them were friends of friends, there was sort of a domino-like collapse of relationships, of marriages of a certain vintage, all for different reasons. Because no marriage is, you know, the same, they're all unique. But the common thing, I suppose, was the vintage of them. They were all 15 to 20 years married. And it seemed to me that a lot of them had sort of got to a point where there were less pressures on a marriage at that point. There were no, you know, super young children, toddlers, babies, nascent careers. The pressures on an early marriage had largely, they'd gotten through that, they'd weathered those crises. And this is when it was all falling apart. And I was really fascinated by that. I guess I'm fascinated by human relationships anyway. But when I'm fascinated with something for long enough, inevitably a book project is not far away. I think that fiction enables me to explore things that I'm interested in. It's a process that, for me, it allows, you know, what's involved in writing a book is a lot of research, a lot of observation, interviewing people, all the skills I guess that I learned also through a journalism career prior to moving into fiction. And by the end of it, I wouldn't say that I necessarily have the answer to whatever the problem was that I was, you know, inspecting, but I certainly have a much better understanding of it. And yes, fiction allows me to do that. So this book came out of that, but I didn't want to just look at one marriage or one relationship. I didn't think that was sufficient for what I was trying to explore. So for a while I pondered how best to approach it from a structural point of view to really enable what I wanted to do. And in the end I came up with creating a character who is a marriage counsellor who herself is blindsided in her marriage, didn't see it coming. And I, at the time I was working at a university and promoting academic research, and one of the academics I worked with was in the psychology department, a very experienced relationships and marriage counsellor. And I was chatting to her one day and I said, you know, what do you think of this idea, by the way? Is that implausible? Do you think it's from, you know, given that you work in this space, is that a ridiculous assumption to think that someone with all your expertise, all your observational skills when it comes to the intricacies of relationships could have the rug pulled from under them? And she said, Carrie, absolutely not implausible, completely plausible, and here's why. And then she piled up my arms with textbooks and said, go forth and research. And I did. And that once I'd hit upon that structure or that plot for the book, I was confident that I could explore lots of pressures on marriage and relationships. And I also wanted to, and I think all of my fiction is, I don't want to use the word uplifting, but I'm going to use the word uplifting. I definitely don't set out to paint, you know, to take people through a difficult process that is unresolved by the end, or there's a sense that, well, relationships, why bother, you know. I wanted to create some hope for, in particular, the relationships closest to me that fell apart several years ago. Those friends, you know, really went through difficult times, really hard. And when you're emotionally close to people like that, and you're an empath like me, you really feel for them, and you want to see them get through this journey, and they do. And I noticed that on the other side of that journey, when once you're through the heartache, some really unexpected things can lie there that you would never have otherwise thought if you hadn't been through this, you know, very, very difficult passage of time. So I sort of wanted to have a character who ultimately does make it through that journey. That was a really long-winded way to say that's why I wanted to write about this. But I guess, yeah, that is not an elevator pitch by any means. It's the longest elevator ever.
It's all right, we've got plenty of time.
We're in the stratosphere now. But that's where it came from.
I'm interested when you talked about it as a problem to solve in terms of, you know, the intention of the book, because I've often heard other creative people talk about their artwork in the same way. It's that I tried to solve a problem in my mind, which I find completely fascinating. So, the medium that you work in, it's an incredibly labour-intensive one, and it sounds like just the fact that a fellow academic gave you a bunch of textbooks made it particularly, particularly labour-intensive. Can you sort of identify how long it took you in terms of the genesis of the idea and, you know, this week, which is book launch week?
Gosh, I think that I was observing and turning this nugget over in my mind for probably 2 years.
And I thought it would have been longer. That's impressive.
Yeah, I definitely wasn't diarising it, but I think it was about 2 years that I was just mulling it over and watching and observing. And look, selfishly, I too am I'm a middle-aged married woman too. So I think at the same time my own marriage went through a wobbly period, making it even more interesting for me making it more necessary for me to look at this thing more closely and not to take it for granted but to actually unpack it. So then the writing process was a very different one to the first time. So the first book I wrote, where there was, you know, no publishing contract, no chance of it, no guarantee that it would ever go anywhere. So there's nothing really tying you time-wise. You can take as long as you want because no one cares. And so that did take me several years to write. But this one, I set myself a deadline because actually, to be honest with you, it was also an escape route from a job that had become all-consuming. So when COVID hit and I was working, I was running a comms team at a university. Mm-hmm. You know, no comms team is set up for a pandemic, and universities in particular, as anyone in the space would know, have a lot of pain points when it comes to a pandemic, and almost every problem is solved by communications. Mm. So it became a crazy job, like 16-hour days, no weekends, and the back end was falling away. So that's fine if you don't also have three kids at home. So I started to think, but I also didn't want to be that person who goes, hey guys, I'm out, I can't handle it. No one wants to be that person. So I came up with the idea that actually I will exit because I'm going to write this book.
Okay.
And everyone's happy for you when you say it like that. Mm. Everyone, you know, good on you, Carrie, what a brave thing to do, good on you, you know. So you get nice parties and send-offs and flowers and well wishes, and then the next day you get home and you sit in front of your computer and you say, shit, now I have to write this book because I told everyone I'm going to do it. So that is essentially what happened. And I said,
that's accountability. Public accountability.
Public accountability. There is nothing more motivating. And So I said to my husband just before I pulled the pin, can we do this? I've never actually carved out time to write before. I have always squished it in around paid work, like just in the crevices every time, everywhere you can squeeze it in. I've never ever just said, I'm just going to write. It's financially a stupid thing to do. I said, but can we do this? Can we just do this for 6 months? I promise you I'll write it in 6 months. And he could not have been more supportive. He said, yep, it'll be a bit hard, but a bit tight, but absolutely do it. Thanks to him. That was great encouragement. What we didn't foresee was that 2 weeks after that, he got made redundant.
COVID.
Thank you, COVID. And then a couple of weeks after that, my eldest daughter, who lives out of home, she's a teacher. Well, she wasn't a teacher at the time. She had a part-time job finishing uni, and the part-time job was cancelled because of COVID. So we covered her rent for several months. So suddenly the timing around finishing the book became, for me, quite tight, and there was an imperative there to get it done. And
did that increase the stress for you? Absolutely. In terms of, you know, you're doing creativity, you're not doing easy by the book stuff. So that's its own challenge. And then you've suddenly got very serious financial pressures on you. Did that affect your ability to write? Or as you say, did it just go, I need to get there. I've got my 6 months.
It definitely, I wrote more efficiently than I've written before, and I devoted far more hours a day to it than I've ever been able to before. So it was motivating in terms of getting it done, but I would say that it was not as enjoyable as the first book. It was a very different writing experience. And I am working on the next book already, I intend to...
We'll ask about that later, yes.
I do intend to not let it become like that again. Yeah. I don't think, look, it is good to have deadlines even in the creative space. You do need to have deadlines even if they're self-imposed. But having, you know, I don't know, a weight hanging, an imaginary anvil over your head about to drop is, I highly don't recommend it.
Yeah.
Having said that, I'm very, very pleased with what came out of it in the end, and the fact that it's now, I don't look back now that there's a bit of clear air between having finished the book and now it's coming out into the world. I look back with more rose-coloured glasses on that period. But during it, no, it was hard. And also because my husband was at home, you know, two people. I don't know many marriages that can survive that for too long. So I did another thing that I did was I treated it much like a job in that I physically, you know, put on pants and shoes and a bra and took my laptop to my friend's co-working space.
Oh, wow.
In Flora Terrace. Mm-hmm. And where there were a lot of other people in doing a lot of other different things, you know, investment bankers and accountants and real estate agents, and they're all working in this co-working space. And so that was actually really good because I treated it like a job. I had people around me who would occasionally go, so how's the book going? And so I got to have conversations and then I would go home, and so that was good too.
It was also a very difficult time psychologically for, I would imagine, most people, just the nature of the pandemic and when it arrived and the fear and the uncertainty, because there was so much that was so unknown at the time. I'm impressed at your capacity to still be focused. A lot of people suddenly had to have their children be homeschooled, you know, with the expectation of still working, and then, of course, internet dropping out and all those kinds of things. I find it remarkable. Yeah, I think it's a huge achievement on its own. It's a huge achievement, but in terms of all of those circumstances, and also leaving a secure job is a big deal as well, because going into a creative space, obviously there's that beauty of being able to gestate and fulfill an idea. That's wonderful, but the uncertainty that comes from that, and it's a testament to skill and discipline and focus. I would imagine that a lot of that has come from your years as a journalist, where you have deadlines, there's pressures and expectations and delivery and things like that. I'm very impressed, so hearty congratulations to you for that.
Thank you so much. You're so right. Psychologically, the pandemic, and I know that Perth has had it a little bit easier than other places, a lot easier.
It was still scary though.
But it was very scary. And I think that actually it's hard to separate that writing experience from the pandemic, because I do think that from a psychological perspective, like a lot of people, things were feeling a little bit apocalyptic, which makes it easier in some ways to throw in a high-paying job because the world's ending anyway, right? I'm joking, but am I?
We didn't really know though, did we? We didn't know what it looked like.
And as for homeschooling, my gosh, what a fail I was. Like I really – this is a true story. My son said to me one day, this is when homeschooling was first put on the table, and there was no sense of when any of this was going to end. This looked like a new forever. And my son had his maths in front of him. I mean, I barely got through maths myself, you know, back in the day.
Yeah.
Now they don't even carry the one anymore. I mean, there's nothing I can help with here. I'm only muddying the waters. So he's like, Mum, you know, this is stupid. I don't get it. And I said, yeah, you're right. Maths is stupid. Let me just paint the picture. I was feeling very existential.
Mm.
And he said, but it's due at 5:20. And I said, what is time?
But a construct.
And then I said to him, you know what, buddy? Right now, I'm going to be really honest with you, none of the grown-ups have this quite worked out yet. We really don't quite know what we're dealing with. We're in uncharted territory and we're making decisions on the fly, and this is a rare moment in time. And if I was you, I would fully exploit it. I would get your wetsuit and your surfboard and I would go to the Indian Ocean, which is right just over the hill, and just enjoy it. And he did, and his wetsuit wasn't dry for 2 months and we did zero homeschooling. Mm. And I don't feel guilty about that now.
No.
It was terrible parenting at the time. But when you talk about psychology, that's where we were at, that things were feeling weird. And in the midst of us having no jobs, by the way, and our mortgage doing a giant, you know, U-turn, I remember one day we went down here in Osborne Park. We actually went to a furniture shop because our couch was falling apart and we just had to get something cheap to replace it. And we ended up buying this ridiculously expensive couch that we didn't need and we would never normally buy in any other headspace because we were like, we're never going to have to pay this off. The world's ending.
And now 18 months later?
And now we've got to pay it off. Very comfy couch though.
That's fantastic. I'd like to talk a little bit about your start in writing. So your career has been in journalism.
Yes.
Did you always write?
Always. My grandma gave me a journal when I was probably 8 or 9 and I started writing in that journal and just instantly loved the feeling of it. And I guess I was writing a diary really, but very quickly I started to embellish it because I was imagining a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And normal life most days is actually not that fascinating. It wasn't enough to say I...
So you wrote your diary for an audience?
I wrote the diary with an imagined audience. Okay. I embellished, I had florid descriptions of things and I thoroughly enjoyed the process even though no one ever did read it. But I guess when I look back, that's where it began. That's where the love for writing and the power of that became really appealing to me.
And also that awareness of engaging an audience.
Yes, that was always there intuitively, I guess.
Clearly.
From a really early age. And also thanks to my grandma, she exposed me to – she was a maths teacher, but she was a member of the library. So she was they call it a friend of the library. She used to volunteer and put books on the shelves. And so she would often take me with her for those shifts. And so I was – instantly in love with libraries because there were stories everywhere, all around me. It was my dream space. So, and she would let me borrow books on her card. And so those two things were happening, that love of reading and the love of writing were happening from an early age. But in terms of a career, no one ever suggested, nor would they, that being an author would be a career from school. That's not... Even now, that's not something that's really painted to you as a pathway where, and I think it should be. I think there are ways that could be a legitimate pathway from school with the assistance of some other work to supplement it. But that was not an option. So really the only other thing that suited my skill set and my interests was journalism. Stories, people, writing, and I'm hugely curious about the human condition. Mm-hmm. Also, my father was a journalist when I was young and hated it and said, and ended up going into real estate, and said to me one day, whatever you do, don't become a journalist. So instantly that was appealing. So I went, when I left school, I went and did a journalism degree at QUT in Brisbane. So I was 17. I left my home in Mackay and went and, you know, moved out of home at 17, basically lived in a big share house, had no money, yep, forged bus passes, did all sorts of things to survive, mm-hmm, and completed that degree, and then was in a tearing hurry to get my first job. And
And where was that first job?
It was called TMPC, which stood for the Magazine Publishing Company in Brisbane in Fortitude Valley. They published a whole suite of industry journals, I guess. Mm-hmm. In fact, the first thing I ever did was sub-edit the entire Queensland Taxi Policy and Procedures Manual, which was fascinating, let me tell you.
Did that have you questioning your path, or could you see beyond that?
I'd like to say that I could see beyond that, but I think younger people today, I'm envious of them, because they do seem to have a mindset that if this isn't working for me, if it doesn't feel right, if it doesn't align with my values, I need to look elsewhere. I did not think like that.
We weren't raised in that space though.
No, I just kept moving, you know, through the process, and every now and then there'd be an enjoyable job. Like, okay, you know, we wrote the journals, or we wrote the souvenir programs for the State of Origin. And I loved my rugby league back then. Mm-hmm. And so that was a great job. So there was swings and roundabouts, I suppose. I hate using that cliche, but I didn't doubt, I never stopped to question the pathway. I didn't actually have a plan B. Mm-hmm. And I also had to pay the rent.
Yeah.
I was out of home.
And so was there always in the back of your mind a goal to write fiction, or did you just sort of think, well, I like writing, this is the way to do it?
Yeah, I wasn't writing fiction at that time. I was just consuming a lot of it. I loved reading articles about writers. You know, how creatives are fascinated by other creatives. Like, I had the subtext of every, you know, article I would read was, you know, how do you do this thing? How do you, you know? And I think I was in that space for a good 20-something years.
Yeah.
And I also had 3 children during that time. So motherhood has a way of swamping creativity and putting a giant pause on it. For me, that was certainly my experience. So I didn't really revisit the idea of writing creatively or writing fiction until I was about 40. And that's when I decided to give it a go, to just start writing and see where that ended up.
But you'd done some nonfiction work. You've done 2 nonfiction books.
Yeah. Well, one of them was really just a collection of columns, because yes, I wrote a weekly column for many years, mm, that was syndicated to a few different newspapers on the East Coast. And I don't know, someone suggested that a collection of them might fall under the heading of you know, because I guess my humour is quite subversive, and I guess I take the piss a bit. So the topic was basically mediocrity, okay, a celebration of mediocrity.
Great theme.
And like, it was the response to the self-help movement at the time. You know, this was basically saying you're fine as you are. In fact, you're probably doing too much. So, you know, just step back.
Lower the bar.
Okay. Do less. And that book was called You Take the High Road and I'll Take the Bus.
Yes.
And that was with Alan and Unwin back in the day. So, yes, I did do that book, and I did one that I don't even want to mention, because it was just a paid gig for a mining company.
Okay.
And I wouldn't do it today. Mm-hmm. I would be much more principled. Yeah, so did do a few little books. And I guess some of my – the column writing was creative in a way. So that may be now that you mention it, when I look back, I think the itch was being scratched by writing columns. I wasn't just writing hard news stories of the day about this politician and that politician and, you know, this car accident, or there was that. There was the nuts and bolts of a journalism degree, but there was also this column that an editor in Mackay gave me, and that grew into this, mushroomed into this lovely thing that for many years gave me a lot of satisfaction. And when I moved into magazines, I lived in Sydney and I became deputy editor of Practical Parenting magazine, ironically, after I've just told you my homeschooling story. they also gave me a column called Womb with a View, which was a lovely way for me each month to, in a funny kind of way, vent about parenting.
Yeah, and you're expressing yourself.
I was expressing myself. So definitely there was a creative aspect to that paid part of journalism. But certainly when you start to write a book, there is no guarantee it'll get published and no one's offering you any money. So that was purely speculative and I didn't know where that would lead. And the fact that it led to a book that someone published still fills me with joy and gratitude.
As it should. It's a huge achievement. Oh, you know, setting goals when you have a lot of other commitments is an undertaking.
Mm.
And that's the creativity that I'm trying to celebrate through this podcast because we constantly see examples of achievement and success, which is wonderful, but there's also a lot of achievement and success that's quieter and doesn't have marketing budgets behind it.
That's right.
But it's no less worthy and valuable, and from a creative perspective, it's the doing as much as the outcome, and that's what I feel is important to celebrate.
Mm.
You know, the fact that it became a published book I think is obviously incredibly wonderful and congratulations, but you were going to write it anyway.
That's true. It had to be written. It had to come out of me. And the thing I find about the creative process that is the hardest to explain because it sounds so ridiculous, but the thing that gives me the most pleasure and satisfaction is when things come out during the writing process, as in like come out of you that you didn't know were in there. There's a reason I think that a lot of, you know, these retreats and self-help workshops these days recommend journaling because it actually unleashes things. It is a really cathartic, joyful, almost transcendental experience at times. Other times it is just hard, hard work, mm-hmm. riddled with self-doubt. There are days where it's just an enormous chore and you are talking yourself off the ledge all the time, and then there are other days where you say, oh my God, this is so worth it. Everything else, you know, this makes it all worth it. That's what I got with the first novel and that's what I certainly experienced with this one too, and that's what I'm experiencing with the one that I'm writing on. And I think once you trust that writing or creativity will deliver you those moments, those pure moments of golden joy and revelation, once you trust that it will happen, it helps you move through the difficult days because you know the good. There'll be a great day down the track.
You wrote your first book, Afternoons with Harvey Beam, in a library. I need to know why, and I'd like to know what it did for your writing to create a book in a public space.
Well, I think, as I mentioned, my grandma did instill in me this reverence for libraries, that they were pretty special places. And I don't think I ever lost that. That wasn't just a childhood perception. I do think they're precious places. And when my children were babies and toddlers, I was that mum at the library all the time, all the story times. I was determined to expose these kids to books and wonder and stories. Anyway, none of them read now, so it turns out I failed spectacularly. Never mind. It remained a very, very precious place for me. So it seemed logical that if I was going to go anywhere to do my writing, it would be a library. And why go anywhere? Why not just do it at home? Because I really needed to wear a different hat and have a different headspace. I do all my other writing at home. I write, you know, blogs for financial advisors at home. So I don't want to be in the same place. I needed to physically do that. The first time I went to Karrinup Library and wrote so much and so well, it was just a really great start and I thought this works for me. If it hadn't got off to such a great start, if I hadn't had one of those great days, who knows? But it just, I thought, oh, this is it. This is where I need to be. I love libraries today too for different reasons than I used to because they've evolved. They're very different. They're no longer full of anywhere near as many books. They are very much digital spaces as well. And for some people, and I would see a lot of the same regular people in the library, the library is critical to their world. They may be, you know, an older IT challenged person, doesn't have a computer at home. There they can go use the computer, get some assistance from the staff. There are kids studying, there are young people, old people, there are some pretty socioeconomically challenged people there for whom the library gives them all sorts of different things, but you can see that it's important to them. So I wasn't just sitting in a library. I think I was also observing, as I'm always doing.
Yeah.
I'm observing this cross-section of life, this microcosm of public life. And I often say that there are as many stories in the library off the shelves as on the shelves. They're full of people. Yeah. They're full of human stories. Yeah. And also they're not quiet places anymore.
No, they're community hubs.
They are. They're busy. They're noisy and they're busy. But that white noise worked for me because I actually don't enjoy writing in complete silence. So, yeah, the library was just great. And so you would think I would have written the second one in the library too. But, again, I needed to put myself in a new headspace again because Afternoons with Harvey Beam to me was synonymous with the library.
Okay.
And I was writing a very different book and needed a different headspace.
Yes.
So my friend's co-working space, Flow Space, worked for me.
Yes.
Right from the get-go. Had a great first day and thought, yep, this is going to work. And then recently I had an epiphany where I had the opportunity to do 2 weeks at the KSP Writers Centre late last year in the Perth Hills, which was an amazing experience. 2 weeks of just writing in a little log cabin, you know, in the bush. And I wondered how I would go with that because it was a foreign environment to me. I was untethered from family and it was either going to go spectacularly well or it would be a bit of a, you know, hashtag awkward 2 weeks. I also had to get past the fact that at night there's no one at the centre. Like I'm just in a log cabin.
Oh, so you stayed there?
Yes. Okay. So I said to people, my husband and friends, like I may die here. I feel like this is a murder waiting to happen. If I was going to murder someone, this would be the perfect, you know, no one's going to hear me scream. Anyway, that's an aside. Clearly I made it through and it was a wonderful experience. I wrote more in that week than I've ever written before. Like normally it used to be for me 500 words, that's a good day.
Mm.
I was writing 1,000 to 1,500 words every day. I really crashed through that. It was a great 2 weeks. And what it showed me is that actually, Carrie, it's not about place. It's about time. It's about giving it the time. So now I'm actually writing at home a lot more but I'm doing it in a more dedicated way where I will actually, even on a day where the words aren't flowing, I will sit with it for 3 or 4 hours.
Yes.
Because I know that time in the end, just putting in the time works. You don't have to be in a particular place.
And being at home doesn't, you know, when things are stalling, you're not distracted because I would imagine that could also be challenging.
Oh, for sure. Distractions. Yeah.
Just put a load of washing on or I'll just sort this out and it'll come to me.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. Nowadays when I hit the writer's block, when that's happening or it's a chapter that I just can't quite nut out, I do just throw on a pair of shoes and go for a walk around the block.
Okay.
And
you break that spell.
I do. Mm-hmm. Or I have a shower. So the ideas come in the shower or walking on the coast.
I've heard quite a few people refer to the shower as very soothing.
Yeah, I don't know.
For ideas.
Yes. So you do need to just remove yourself from the desk and do that. And I've now worked through the domestic distractions problem.
Yes.
I think I've got better at that. It did used to be problematic. But I'm just getting better, like you do with most things. It's not always going to be convenient to get up and go somewhere else all the time. Sometimes it's helpful to be at home. I also have a lovely little dog now and a daughter who's at home, and so I do feel I should be there for them.
I think it's also really nice because it allows you to be on your own time, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, you are owning your days. You are owning your creativity, how it comes, how it's delivered, and that autonomy. I think it's a really fortunate position to be in and obviously one that's very well earned. So it also makes sense now that you're working on your third book, which I will ask about in a moment. You have, as you say, ironed out those problems. I think that those are all little achievements because at the end of the day, it's all about finding those ways to access and unlock your creativity but we're all functioning in a world that has requirements and demands. Throw off your headspace. So you've achieved a level of discipline, I suppose, through the process of having done the work that you've done. I really like the idea that your different projects have required different spaces of you because, again, it's following the instinct of this is what this project needs for me. I'm just quite intrigued by it. And now you've got enough control over all of that that you can go, okay, I want to be at home. I'm going to do it this way. And it's clearly working for you.
I think it's more that over time I've developed trust in the creative process. For a long time I didn't trust it and I thought it had to have all these particular attachments to make it work. I couldn't write anywhere but the library. I couldn't write anywhere but flow space. I had all these superstitions completely of my own design, which if you actually inspect them, they all come from a place of fear, because being creative can be scary, as in
it's unknown.
It's unknown.
And tenuous.
And what if it doesn't come? What if it doesn't happen, you know? So there's this fear and these superstitions around it, and I think over time they have dissipated with – I've now replaced them with trust in myself and in the creative process, that it will come and I don't have to have this particular window or looking at this window or this particular – my lucky pants on or anything, you know. The only thing I don't write well of an afternoon, so I do know that about myself. I need to be sitting down at 8:30, 9 o'clock and do as much as I can before, say, 1. Mm-hmm. And that isn't a superstition. That's just me knowing my own brain.
That's your reality. Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, you know, because that's still a good productive 4 to 5 hours.
Yep. And I think when you're writing a novel, actually, it's – realistically, you're not going to get much more out of yourself than that in a day. Yeah. The other time is reflecting on what you've written. Like in the afternoons, I'm reflecting a lot on what I've written that day and thinking about where I'm going to pick up tomorrow. So even though that isn't, you know, that's kind of just head time, that's just time in your own head, it is still part of the writing process.
Yeah.
And
yeah, all of it is.
It is. And very rare. And maybe I'll listen to a podcast. You know, I love listening to podcasts in this space, you know, about other writers. I love hearing about other writers, especially when you hear established writers talk about the difficulties they still have or the days where it just doesn't happen, or where they read a piece of work that they've just written and go, this is rubbish. And you think, Helen Garner has self-doubts? What? It's so healthy to listen to that stuff. So sometimes in the afternoon I might do that as well, but equally that's kind of writing too, isn't it? That's kind of like my professional development.
Yeah, the wheels continue to tick over just because, you know, your hands aren't on the keyboard.
Yeah, but I'm amazed when I read about or hear about writers who – like only write, you know, like they start at 9 o'clock at night and then they punch it out till, and I think that's bedtime.
I don't believe them.
I don't believe them either. What are they, completely nocturnal?
Whose work do you admire, you know, and whose work motivates you?
In recent years, there's been a little sort of a whole slew of, and they've been mostly debut authors who, and they're younger, and they're writing about human relationships and they're writing about difficult characters and the flaws of the human condition, and they're doing it with some humour mixed in. And the people I've loved in recent years, I loved Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason, one of my favourite books, and I loved Emily Maguire's Little Objects. And there's a whole sort of group of writers in that space in recent years who I've admired because they're doing this really great introspective work that I thought I had to be 40 years old to do, and they're doing it in their 20s, and I think, good on you. You know, and also they've not, you know, bought the idea that I had, that I couldn't start writing until I'd, you know, slogged it out as a journalist and a mum for 20, 30 years, and now I can do it. They're carving out the time now, so I really admire that a great deal. But I also admire, you know, just creators of beautiful prose and human observation like Helen Garner. I mean, amazing, you know, and I listened to her at the Perth Writers Festival recently too, and just was in awe of the way she looks at life and then is able to translate that, and how she can wade actively into the difficult things, the difficult, you know, because in this next book that I'm writing, I am wading into a more difficult area than I'm used to before. Mm-hmm. And so reading and hearing from those sort of people is inspirational to me, because I think sometimes the dark spaces can be quite illuminating from a creative perspective. And I also like people who can be funny in their writing. You know, that's a real skill in itself. And I admire a lot of literary writers, because that's what I aspire to write literary fiction, but I'm not there yet. And maybe I never will be. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Robert Lucan's just released his new book. I mean, it's just the most poetic prose you've ever written, and maybe I'll never get to that point. But that is what I consume and what I look up to.
It's interesting that you've said you aspire to be a certain kind of writer, and that's not the writer that you are now. And obviously you may end up being any kind of writer, you know, as you continue to develop. But it's interesting because you have immense talent, but your aspiration is not where your voice currently is. How do you feel about that?
Depends on what time of day you ask me. Some days I really struggle with that, because I guess I'm mindful of like being pigeonholed as just a writer of commercial fiction. And
is that a bad thing?
Well, on the good days, I think that's not a bad thing, because I you know, commercial fiction mean, you know, if it sells well, means you're connecting with a lot of readers.
Exactly.
Which is ultimately what I want to do. I mean, connection with readers and feedback from readers is what I live for. It's what I'm terrified of, and it's what I live for. You know, when I've done book talks and people have come up to me and said, your book, you know, resonated with me because of this thing that happened in my life, and then they will tell this amazing story. What a privilege to hear that. I mean, and there's no other way in life I could have made that opportunity happen than to have written my book and had it connect with someone enough for them to feel that they were compelled to tell me their story. I don't know how you can fabricate those. I don't know how you can create those opportunities in any other way.
No.
So I am grateful for that, because commercial fiction, it does reach a lot of people. I guess though, my reverence for really beautiful writing means that I sort of I aspire to one day, and I may never get there, write a less commercial work and more of a literary work. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that keeps me up at night.
You might not see that, but having been reading Afternoons with Harvey Beam, there's some brilliant prose in there that you should be proud of.
That's so nice of you.
But it's true, and I don't think that, with respect, I don't think that you can be objective as well, probably. So it's interesting where you are and what an outsider or a stranger or a reader sees. I can see some prose in Afternoons with Harvey Beam that are at that level.
That's so nice of you. And it is very hard to be objective about your own work. You're so right. I mean, this morning I woke up and my husband said, there's a review on Goodreads of your book. And I said, do not go on with this conversation. Do not tell me what it is, because I'm not ready for the bad stuff.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about that is, in my mind, it could just go either way. Like I find it so hard to be confident and objective about my work that it was just as likely for him, the next words out of his mouth, to be, but it's a really good review, or for him to say, yeah, it's a shocker. Mm. Both of those things seemed completely plausible to me, because I find it hard enough to be, I'm not yet confident enough to be objective about my work. I know that you'll never connect with anyone, because you know, topics don't resonate with everyone. And for example, this one being about marriage of a certain vintage and middle age is not going to probably appeal to a 20-year-old. And I get that. But what would devastate me is that someone that I am writing for, someone who is in that target market, read it and didn't like it. You know, that it should have been what they wanted. It was definitely about the topics that they're interested in, but somehow it failed them. They're the reviews that I that hurt and that make me go, okay, how can I do this better? So it is hard to be objective about your own work and your own style. I find that the hardest question to answer when people say, what's your style of writing? And I think, oh, my God. I'm like, A, first of all, look at the way I dress. I have no style. Style is a foreign concept
Harsh.
To me. Most days I'll get dressed and I'll say to my daughter, am I working? Is this working? And she'll just give me like a thumbs up or a thumb. Like it could go either way. I literally have no idea. Literally, I could be looking amazing or I could be looking ridiculous. I need someone else to tell me to save the world from that.
I think it's also hard. I think the vulnerability must have a lot of pressure to it when your work becomes public, which is a fantastic achievement. But I do also sense that there's a lot of armchair critics, and something that Brené Brown said, which I stick in the back of my mind, is if you're not in the arena participating, you don't get to have a say or an opinion, which I think is a better way of people evaluating, because it's too easy and criticism can also be a sport. The negative impact is not necessarily productive or justified, and that must make it incredibly challenging to have achieved to this point.
Mm. Oh, for sure. For a highly sensitive person like myself, and I've actually become more sensitive, not less sensitive as I've got older. I don't know what's going on there.
I think that happens.
Does
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to care less, but I seem to care more. For someone like me, doing this, bearing my soul and opening my whole, cracking open my chest and letting all the creativity coming out, putting it onto a page, making it into a book and sending it out into the world and effectively saying, hey, read this, let me know what you think. Mm. I mean, nothing could be more stupid for my personality than to do this. And I won't lie to you, with my book coming out this week, I am in a state of terror at the moment.
Okay.
And it's
You know, how do you manage that?
Oh,
You know, does the publishing company give you a coach and some some therapy to support you?
Well, let's hope the thirsty camel never shuts down anytime soon. But no, they are actually very good. I think that the publicist in particular, I think they've never been explicit about this, but I think the unwritten rule is they just tell you the good stuff.
Yeah.
She's never going to read me a bad review. But she told me the other day, oh, my God, the editor of this magazine said it was the best book she'd read this year and she's going to make it. And, I mean, that got me through the whole time.
Yeah.
That's what you need to hear. So yeah. I think that if you're going to work in this difficult space, and any creative will know this, you need to surround yourself with the people who love you, the people who will catch you when you fall, the people who will still admire your work even when didn't quite get it right. The people who get the fact that you do this difficult thing emotionally, they know that you should be doing something else that's better for your mental health, but they love you anyway, and that's the thing. Writing is very much, it's so solitary in the writing process, so you need to surround yourself with good people who believe in you.
So this book that is about to be launched, you mentioned there, you know, when you get it right, do you feel you got it right with this book?
I do.
Does that help bolster you, or does that just fall away at the side of criticism? Regardless, you know, that sense of, no, I know what I achieved. You don't have to like it, but I know what I achieved.
I think you just have to keep – it's not a permanent state of mind. You have to keep –
of course.
Yeah, you just have to keep reminding yourself all the time, sometimes hourly, but usually daily. Remind yourself why you're doing this, why you set out to write this particular book with this topic, where this whole thing started.
Yes.
And that the sun will rise, the sun will set – and you're a good person, and it's all okay. And also that this too will pass, and, you know.
It sounds harrowing.
It's also joyous. When someone really loves it, there's nothing better. Yeah. I mean, you know, when someone connects with it.
And that's what it's about, isn't it? Connection, a sense of connection with others. That's what art is.
It is.
That's why it's important.
It is. It's just beautiful dot joining exercise, this linking of hearts and minds and souls and I wouldn't work in any other space. I know I've made it sound horrific at times, but I imagine life would be less fulfilling in the broader sense if I wasn't doing this difficult thing.
And are you still doing journalism as well?
Well, I still teach journalism and I've sort of transitioned in recent years to comms, communications, but it's the same skill set, you know. So I'm currently working part-time as a communications manager for an arts organisation. So I'm still, doing work to pay the bills.
Yeah.
But journalism remains a big love and I consume a lot of news.
So the title of this podcast is Tell Me What You're Working On. Given that you're just releasing a book at the time of recording, I'll change it to any ideas yet on what's next? You've referred to a third book, so can you tell me what's on the horizon?
Well, I was very fortunate that Affirm Press, who are publishing So Many Beats of the Heart, soon after I signed the contract, said, we'd like to offer you a contract for a second book. And I was really surprised because this the book wasn't even out. I mean, it could, you know, they were really, it was quite speculative on their behalf. And I said to my agent, is this normal? And she said, no, it's not. Sign. I was like, okay. So I started writing. I'm two-thirds of the way through the next book, which is about a totally different topic, but it was something that was germinating and sitting with me for some time before it had the same genesis as the other books, where I'm observing something, wondering about it, pondering it, turning it over in my mind to the point where I need to actually write to lift the bonnet up of the car and have a much better look at how this whole thing works. So this time, for want of rather than give you a long-winded plot, which I know for people who aren't writers is like when someone tells you what they dreamt about, like, let me tell you about my dream. And you're just like, oh, my God, seriously, no. So I might do that too. I will just say this: the tagline is beauty, vulnerability and the healing power of storytelling.
Ooh, I'm intrigued already.
See, I've tried that a few times and everyone goes, ooh, I like that. And so I'm just going to keep running with that.
It's a great sales pitch and that's what you want. So curiosity in terms of the process. So you're two-thirds through writing it. So is that something that would be published in, say, 24? Is that what we're looking at, or late 23?
I would think late 23, okay. Yeah. But I definitely aim to be finished it in the next few months.
Okay.
Because actually of all the books, of all the projects I've worked on, this one is the most enjoyable. You know, I said that writing so many beats of the heart because of the pressures of COVID, losing jobs, husband losing job, was not necessarily an enjoyable process, not as enjoyable as it should have been. This one, on the other hand, is actually, I can't wait each day. When I have a writing day, like, I can't wait to get there, which is really nice, really nice. I mean, I hope that that's not just me. I hope that that translates into something that other people will really like as well. Yeah. And it would be mortifying to me if the book that I feel best about ends up being like the one where the publisher goes, nah, we're not really feeling it. Mm-hmm. At this point I feel like I'm as I spoke to you before about, you know, that aspiration of writing in a more literary way, mm-hmm. I think I'm achieving it with this next book. And there's something to be, I think because I've written it too, there wasn't a big gap between these two projects. Mm-hmm. There was a short gap, and so There's something to be said for momentum in creativity too. I think momentum is really important.
Yes.
It's like a marathon, and, you know, you get to a point too where you've gone so far into the race that you're not going to abandon it. You've got the momentum. You're nearly there. You can, you know, so I feel that with this book.
So you're in the midst of writing your next book. You're releasing your second book. So you're going to commence the publicity process and all the talks, potentially writers' festivals, depending on time of the year.
Yep.
Is it difficult to jump from headspace, or will you pause the writing whilst you go through the thick of the publicity process?
It is difficult to do the two things simultaneously. And I definitely think, so we're coming up, the next 2 weeks are jam-packed with publicity opportunities, beautifully created by the publicist at a firm. She's done a wonderful job, and is back-to-back interviews and I'm doing a book tour of Sydney next weekend for a couple of days. So the next 2 weeks are so crazy that realistically, I actually thought this last night, realistically I can't be down on myself if I don't touch the new book very much. It's just not possible. Having said that, I've already thought, oh, 5-hour flight to Sydney. Imagine how much writing I can get done then. I'll just watch 2 movies. Who am I kidding?
I was thinking I'd be thinking about the in-flight movies.
Yeah, I was just kidding. Fooling myself. So no, there may be a pause, but I will come back to it with a flourish as soon as I can.
Yeah, that's incredible. Carrie, if people want to find out more about you, where can they follow you?
I would like to find out more about me too. So if they do work
something out. I can tell you, I did the research.
Can they tell me? Sorry. No, I'm a terrific oversharer on Facebook and Instagram. Yeah. So under my own name, so feel free to watch that space. I don't have a website. And people can, if any creatives out there listen to this and want to have a talk about the creative process, these are conversations I love to have. So please send me an email to carryon, CARRION, at bigpond.com.
Carrie, it's been wonderful to meet you and talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations and all the best.
I have loved this conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
This project has been made with the support of the City of Stirling through their Community Creativity Fund.